Welcome everyone to Wise Talk. This is Mariposa's monthly podcast. We're providing perspectives on leadership. Today, we're excited to welcome David Dye. He is the president of Let's Grow Leaders and co-author of Courageous Cultures, How to Build Teams of Micro Innovators, Problem Solvers, and Customer Advocates. David, I want to hear more from you, of course, in a minute here. I'm so glad to have you. We know that you're a former executive and elected official. After 2 decades of leading teams and building organizations, you met your soulmate. She is Karen Hart. She's your co-author and co-writer, business partner. You started Let's Grow Leaders, a leadership development company where you provide resources and tools to help leaders create lasting change. And between the two of you, you've written several books, including Winning Well, 7 Things Your Team Needs to Hear, and now your latest is Courageous Cultures. So welcome. Thank you so much for coming to us today. And you're in Maryland. You're outside of where?
Well, thank you so much. Absolutely. It's a delight to be with you. And yes, we're in Maryland in Laurel, which if you're not familiar with the geography is halfway between DC and Baltimore.
Cool. Great. So I always ask the same question to start these. And this is, I think, our 15th year doing this. So I read your bio and want to hear more from you in terms of your own personal journey. How did you get to influencing? What were the things that influenced you to write this book?
Yeah, it's you can start all the way back at the beginning, but I'll come a little more recently. Is that so? Our you had mentioned Winning Well, a manager's guide to getting results without losing your soul, and that is really our platform management, leadership, human-centered approach to those topics. Very practical, and so for a number of years we've been working with leaders and companies around the world, you know, helping leaders gain those skills. And as we were doing that, and we'd have more consultative time with senior leaders and executives at or in organizations, we would hear them frequently say things like, you know, one of my frustrations is that I'm having to do all the thinking around here. Why, I see problems and I know other people are seeing them, but why are they not contributing solutions or ideas or things like that? And then we would go and do the frontline trainings in those same organizations. And the people there would say things like, you know, no one really wants to hear my ideas. They don't want to hear what I've got to say. And we look at each other and say, are you working in the same organization? And this was a frequently encountered experience so often that we said, we've got to do some work on this. So we partnered with the University of Northern Colorado Social Research Lab to do some in-depth research around why this gap exists, what effective leaders do to overcome it. And that took us in a number of different directions. And so that's one reason we wrote the book, was to help leaders bridge that gap and build the teams they need. The other reason was because as we're looking, and this is starting out about 3 years ago, as we're looking at the future of work and what's happening and the dynamic shifts that are occurring, you know, between the gig economy and the increasing role of artificial intelligence and the commodification of so many routine type things, anything a computer can do, it's going to do. That journey is well underway and that momentum is rolling. The distinguishing competitive advantage for organizations, we believe, is going to be their people, because the computer systems and routines, all of that, that's just going to be the price of entry. So leaders who are going to be effective over time are going to be those who are bringing their people in all of their full creativity, problem-solving capacity to the table. And so we wanted to write a book to help leaders do that.
Cool. That sounds great. So let's talk about Courageous Culture. Tell me, and who's on the call, what does that mean to you? What does it look like? I mean, we can make like ideas about it, but I'm curious how you define it.
Yeah, absolutely. It's actually a great question, because it's there's a lot to it. So I'm just going to start. I'm going to break it down. Let's go with culture first. So my favorite definition of culture was provided by Seth Godin. So the marketing guru, Seth Godin, he says, culture is simply people like us do things like this. That's culture. It's how people like us do. It's what we do. Well, what is a courageous culture? So it's easier to look at this in contrast. It kind of a default culture is a culture of safe silence. I'm not going to raise my hand. I'm not going to contribute because it feels safer not to. It may not actually be, but it feels safer not to. And there are a lot of reasons we can get into why that is. In a courageous culture, however, people like us, what do? We raise our hand. We speak up on behalf of the customer to improve a efficiency, a process, the employee experience. And that's the norm. That's the default, is that we all contribute. So why do we call it a courageous culture? It's a, there's a bit of a paradox there, because if you have a culture where the norm is that we speak up, we solve problems, we raise issues and contribute solutions, if everyone's doing that, it actually requires less daily courage for any one person to go there. The reason we call it a courageous culture is because to build it takes courage. Someone has to go first, and that's a leader's job.
Right.
And that's where the courage and courageous cultures comes in.
Okay. So to build this infrastructure, what does that take? And then what are the advantages to having it like that?
So a number of things. So, you know, let's start with the advantages. So when you're talking about, let's take the pandemic, for instance, we released Courageous Cultures in July of 2020, right? Mid pandemic.
And you wrote it all before the pandemic.
Oh yes. We started 3 years ahead of that. And it happened to, you know, with publishing deadlines, and it was scheduled a year out, and this is when it's going to be released. And who knew there was going to, Well, it was a perfect example of why organizations benefit from a courageous culture. So if you think about, let's just say a 100-person department or team, or even a smaller business who is looking at the changing world in front of them, the rapidly changing world of dealing with pandemic life. If you've got an organization with one leader who is taxed with figuring it all out, they're going to perform at a certain level. Even if that leader is brilliant, they've got a certain level of performance. Compare that to the organization who has 100 people, all of whom are thinking creatively about, okay, what are the challenges here? Where do we most need to be innovating? And what are, you know, if the leader says, hey, listen, these are the top three things we've got to solve for, but now we're getting 100 people's worth of solutions, contributions, and creative ideas. It's no contest. The parallel processors are going to win. And so that's just an example of the kind of competitive advantage you accrue when you build a culture where everybody can contribute and problems get dealt with much more quickly, much more efficiently. And we're all looking for those daily, what we call micro innovations, ways to improve processes, efficiencies, outcomes, the way that we're interacting with customers, the way we're dealing with one another. And so all of those provide the benefits that lead to competitive advantage. So that's answering the second half of your question.
Right. Well, so lots of talk certainly about culture in our world as coaches, and this whole year we're devoting Wise Talk to culture and organizational culture. And, you know, culture has been sort of hard to come by. Like usually my definition is similar to yours. It's like, you know, culture is what, how things are around here. Well, the here is kind of not here anymore because we're dispersed and we're all at home. So how have you helped people even define culture? Not forget about courageous culture, but just define the idea of culture. And so that's first thing. And then second, how are you advising or working with folks, leaders around doing more of this engagement where people have a voice and in the practices that the way, for example, the leaders are modeling that on Zoom and other places, because right now it's all we got. And I know that's going to shift, but I don't know how much it's going to shift, frankly. We're still going to be on Zoom a lot. So those are a bunch of questions there.
Absolutely. So I'm going to figure out which order to tackle them because you had sparked a thought there.
How to define culture and then how. Yeah.
So let's start. Yeah. Let's start with the culture aspect when there is no here, or here is everywhere, or our living room, or what have you. And I think this is a really important conversation for leaders to have, because what here looks like, or what people like us look like, that is constantly changing. And it's different in every business, right? There are some businesses who never went remote because they couldn't. And there are some who have split that. And then there are some, you know, I've worked, one of our clients is manufacturing. And so they've got a lot of their folks that are working from home. And then a lot of folks who they couldn't leave the
manufacturing, right? Yeah.
you know, and then you've got others that are 100% and have sold their headquarters, right? So you've got kind of this whole range of, you know, the whole experience there. So, but what people like us do, how we treat one another, how we interact, our norms and how we support, how we deal with conflict, how we deal with broken promises when we let one another down, how we are in terms of our responsiveness, how we collaborate, how we socialize. Those are all questions for which there are answers. And those answers are either intentional or they're accidental. And when they're accidental, they're not always what we want them to be. And so if I just take our business as a for example, we are a fully remote business. Now, Karen and I, my wife, co-author, business partner, we own the business together. And so obviously we are co-located, but we're the only ones. Everybody else in the organization is remote. But there are still norms about how people like us act. And we talk about those. What does it look like for us to show up in a way that is consistent with our brand, whether we're online, whether we're talking to a client or we're talking to one another, and you know, the values that we share. Organizations that, you know, we have clients that are global companies and work with people in every time zone around the world. And so culturally for them, what do people like us do in terms of how we schedule meetings and how we respect one another's time in a world that is increasingly difficult to carve out? Thinking
right.
What are
the boundaries?
Right. You know, so those are just a couple of like easy examples, but people like us still act in a particular way, whether we're in the same room or we're in the same Zoom room. You know, that those things still exist. So what is our cultural norm about how we interact online like this? When are we going to have our cameras on? When are we going to let them be off so that we get that break? How are we going to connect socially? You know, before a meeting, how are we going to schedule those meetings so that people have the room to process and recover and, you know, all those kinds of things. You know, there are any, take any question about how people like us act and what, how people like us behave. It's a cultural question and that culture exists. So it's a matter of paying attention to it. And as you know, we've all been doing this now long enough for those who are in the remote environment, that it's now we have enough data, we have enough experience to pull back and say, you know, I really like the way that work, that is not working for us at all. Let's talk about some alternatives. That's a starting point in terms of culture. And I think where people have run into problems with wrapping their head around culture in the new world in this kind of environment is, if your definition of culture was only about margarita 330 or, you know, a game or an activity that was played in person or, you know, something like that, then yes, that doesn't exist the same way, but you still have people and those people are still interacting. And all of that is culture.
So as we go into the what I'm going to call the hybrid, the next normal, there's going to be, you know, when we first went out 15 months ago, we all went out. And unless you're in manufacturing or a lab, you know, virtually most people are out. And so we all did it together. We're all in that same boat, so to speak. It was up to the manager to, or the policy of the company to put together things that maybe would affect the whole company. What's going to happen now is that, you know, not everybody's in the same boat. Like some companies will choose to do work from everywhere, anywhere. Some people will choose to do hybrid. Some people will choose to, you know, all go back to the office, but in all cases, it's going to have to be really, really communicated. And so, talk a little bit about that. Like, I'm concerned for my clients that if it's not going to be the same, like in our case, we're still remote, it's going to be the same. So our practices are going to be the same as going to the hybrid, but most companies, that's not going to be the case. It's going to be something that's going to be different. So what's your advice around how people can over communicate some of these norms and practices?
Yeah. So there's a principle in courageous cultures that we call galvanize the genius. And that is that whenever you're taking any concept that is critical to the success of your team, business, organization, that you want to, we call it 5x5 communication, 5 times, 5 different ways. The idea is that
that's good.
Critical key messages people are hearing in routine ways like email and Zoom chat and, you know, and text Slack message, whatever project management, whatever systems you're using. But then that one or two of those five different ways are also creative and disruptive and break with how we normally expect to get messages. So I was just talking with a director of training today who, because the entire 13,000 person company is entirely remote, and she's struggling to get the FaceTime and, you know, just with every, as so many meetings everybody's having. So we were talking about, okay, what's part of your 5x5 strategy? And, you know, as we talked through, she says, you know, I could do fun 60-second videos that go into somebody's email. Boom. There it is with the critical message. Hey, you just saved $20 million. Want to know how? Click play, you know, and there she is going, hey, this is what happened. This is the training. And as people are implementing this, this is the outcome that you're getting. Wanted to let you know, let me know how I can support you and save you even more money.
Fun.
Right. So yeah. that's a creative example. And there's just so many, you know, whether t-shirts, change your Zoom background, there's just 1,000 different ways to do it. But when we start thinking about critical communication, 5 times 5 different ways at minimum, and you know, people got it when they're snoring it in their sleep or making jokes about it because it's that ingrained. So that said, going back to the first half of your question, what is it that we're communicating? And are we paying attention to that hybrid experience and ensuring that we're creating a playing field that is going to engage the hearts and minds of all of our people at that level? And I don't believe that there is a single answer to that. I think it depends on the context, the work you're doing, the industry you're in. There's a lot that goes into that and the kind of things you're doing. But one thing that I have noticed is, and we hear this particularly from our team's clients where, let's say prior pre-pandemic, they had 10 people who were co-located and then 4 people around the world, that those 4 people around the world have felt better in this environment, because you know, they're on an equal playing field. Well, leaders, we should learn from that.
Yes.
Let's pay attention to that. What can we do when we are holding a meeting, for instance, that's going to incorporate those 4 people? Maybe everybody takes that from their desk or from a laptop or from how, maybe there's a way to, or even if the 10 are in the same room, maybe they're on a, you know, create a similar kind of experience so that you're providing the same level of engagement for everybody, but also capitalizing on the in-person aspect. So there, you know, I think there's not one answer, but those are the questions we need to be asking and thinking about. Okay. So how do we do that? How do we engage people? One of the things that we have a number of different tools that we give leaders in the book, but one of the starting places is to recognize that permission is insufficient. If we want people sharing ideas and speaking up, saying, I've got an open door, I've got an open door. I'd love to hear your ideas.
Not just like sufficient. We just did, right? Just, okay, throw it open.
Right.
Doesn't mean it's going to happen.
It doesn't mean it's going to happen because it still takes more effort and courage at some level and energy to walk through that open door. Like, I've got work to do. You know, I got a job to do. I'm working. It's going to take me time and energy to walk through that door and share something. And so the purpose for open door policies is to deal with the courage crushers that you were talking about. The alternative to an open door, the more intentional way for leaders to start soliciting ideas is get really clear about where you need a great idea. So maybe it's, hey, as we are returning to the office in a hybrid way, if that's your work reality, we need every idea we can get about how to do that in a way that's going to leverage some of the gains we've experienced over the last year and create a healthy, productive, good environment for everyone and help us achieve the results we did without getting back into some of the negative stuff that happened before. Mm-hmm. We need every idea on that topic, right? So if you can get really clear about where you need a great idea, and then it's about asking courageous questions. Mm-hmm. And a courageous question is one that is both specific and it's vulnerable. So when I say, listen, I know there was some stuff that wasn't so good before, and there's been some parts that are really working well, but there's stuff that isn't working as well. Love to get your thinking on how we can improve going forward. Mm-hmm. That's specific. How we can improve is we're coming back into the office looking for those ideas. Mm-hmm. But it's vulnerable because it acknowledges that improvement is possible, and that creates a safer environment for people to speak up.
Right. So it's a vicious circle or a good circle. And it's the vulnerability and the clarity are really important. I'm getting what you're saying. That's great. Okay, so this question comes to us. It's the remote space we're in, and also as we're going into hybrid, what are the challenges leaders are coming to you with?
Yeah, you know what's interesting? And I love the follow-up in this new remote space. I should say not so new remote space, right? There are a number of them. One of them that I have been saddened and pleasantly surprised to see more often than I would have thought is for leaders to be coming and saying, you know, David, Karen, I am really concerned about the emotional health of my people.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not something you heard a whole lot before. Every once in a while, if somebody was struggling or so on, but I've heard that from high powered, like go, go, go type A, triple A sales leaders, you know, who like, they're just that level of gung-ho urgency, but who have said, no, wait, we got to stop. We've got to pay attention. This is, I'm worried about our people. And so I've been heartened to see that concern. And it's a real concern that to our listeners' question, that is one that has been prevalent in many of the conversations. Some that you would expect, you know, we all have lost out on the water cooler, the hallway, you know, all that kind of thing. And so how do we recreate the accidental interactions that breed creativity, relationship, you know, those sorts of things. And in some places, in some respects, you can create virtual water coolers. In other respects, you can't. And so it's understanding what you want to achieve and then figuring out, okay, what are the ways that we can use what is available to get there? Right. So those are two of the big ones.
Yeah. And I just want to add to that, piggyback on to you, David, that some of my clients are, well, all of them are worried about or concerned about isolation and connection. No question about it. There's some facet of that that comes up in our meetings a lot. But one of the things one of them's doing that I really like a lot, and I've told other people about it, and I'll tell you guys, and that is what he does is he'll have a meeting. He'll have a regular meeting, like a group meeting, and then he'll linger by Slacking them right afterwards, and then even get on the phone sometimes. So a lot of more phone calls, you know, just regular phone calls. Right. So that kind of sort of simulates the water cooler a little bit. And so that's worked really well for him. I think that anything we can do to connect in ways that we're not used to, but it's tough. It's tough to do. But I think we're so used to going from box to box to box. And part of the problem is we're putting these meetings, you know, up against each other. Instead of going 1 to 150, we go 1 to 159. And so one easy way to do this is to say, go to 150, and then at least you have the 10 minutes to keep somebody on and or Slack them after real quick, or, you know, like you would do in a meeting. Like that, so much stuff goes on in meetings as somebody walks the person to the next meeting, right? And there's ways to simulate that.
Absolutely. And you can still walk somebody to the next meeting on a phone call, you know, or literally take the meeting walking. I mean, so many different good ideas and solutions that we've heard like that of, you know, clients that, you know, it is a company policy. We do not have Zoom meeting, or I guess, who was it just today came out with that policy where they're eliminating Zoom meetings on Fridays. And like, you're not allowed to schedule any internal meetings, Zoom meetings on a Friday. Okay. I've seen that. I've seen nothing past three. I've seen, we're going to chunk out in the middle of the day for deep think time and not do it there. Or I've seen the, we're only going to schedule them in 40-minute block, and it forces you to have an efficient conversation and stay on task. And everybody wants to get off, you know. And so it's been fun to see the different ways people have approached that, but also the energy with which people engage in these discussions when it's done right. So that's been encouraging.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. Like, I think one of the best ones I've seen is 9 to 12, and then 2 to 5. That's it for Zoom meetings. Everything else has to be go to lunch, go on a walk. I had somebody in a meeting the other day say that they were guilty because they were going on a walk during the middle of the day. Yeah, I just was like, wow. So this is actually in a group meeting. I just was like, wow, you got to be able to do that. But the person that put in these are different people clearly, but the person that put in the 9 to 12 and the two to five is this is the vice president of 200 people. So that was a modeling. And that was the first act that he did as a leader. That was So we went out March 18th. He did that March 20th, like 2 days later. This is what we're doing. It works. And the other thing I'm hearing people doing is no communication, no emails after 8 o'clock. These are all boundaries we need to do to give people a break. Otherwise, the work and the life are just becoming the same.
Yep. I mean, there's so much research around that, that, you know, people's work has expanded. I found it happening to myself, and I have had to model this in my own life of, and particularly as an entrepreneur, right, and business owner, there's always another thing you can be doing. But that tendency when you're not changing location to just keep going became a problem, right? Yeah. It even, you know, and I had to stop it.
I actually put go outside on my calendar every day at 4 o'clock. Okay. Another question from someone here is, as hybrid workplaces, distributed workforces, et cetera, become more normal, asynchronous communication is growing. When communication is not live, how do leaders best model a courageous culture?
I love the question. And I think there is such a powerful role for asynchronous communication, and it contributes to it to a calm workplace that is incredibly productive. I love the work, for instance, that Jason Fried and his team at Basecamp have done around that. They've got some great online documents around this as well. But to answer the question, the same principles apply. So let's talk about how you might do that. So with asynchronous, so we use an asynchronous platform, and every project and every team, we have a specific message board for what we call IDEAs. And IDEA is an acronym, IDEA, that stands for interesting, doable, engaging, actionable. And so what that looks like is we encourage you as a leader or as a team member from either perspective, you can equip your people with this method or you can use it yourself to contribute an idea that has a little bit of thinking to it that has a stronger chance of being implemented and being successful. Interesting means it's strategically relevant. It speaks to something that is important that where we need a great idea. Doable means it's something we have agency over. If it requires a change in regulation and we don't have the lobbying ability to do that, it's not doable for us. Maybe someday, but right now it's not. So do we have agency over this? Is it doable? Engaging. Who are the other people who would likely need to be on board for this in order for it to have legs? And what thinking have I done on their behalf or conversations have I had? So some basic stakeholdering there and their involvement and support if it's there. And then actions. What would be the next one or two practical, observable steps to take in fulfilling this? Well, so that's an idea. In every project, every team, every anything that we do, there is a board specifically for those ideas. And so we have built that into the infrastructure of our business. And so people talk about, hey, I've got an idea. And no one says idea in lowercase. It's now it's idea in all caps.
Right. I.D.E. Yeah, right.
You got it. And then they spell it out. And here's my idea. And here's why it's interesting, doable, engaging, actionable.
Right.
Not everyone gets used. But so that's the first place is you can build stuff like that into the infrastructure. Mm-hmm. Second is you can still ask courageous questions virtually. Right? You can ask them in real time here in this format. You can ask them in a message board thread like that in asynchronous and let people chime in and think it through. And then, I mean, there are so many other ways to cultivate curiosity as a leader. And we get into those in the book, but let's just stick with courageous questions since we've been going there. The other piece that we haven't talked about, and this is critical, and it doesn't matter if you're in real time or asynchronous, it doesn't matter if you're in person or virtual, is to what we call respond with regard. How are you responding to the ideas that you're receiving, the problems that are being brought up, things like that? So there's just three steps here. Regardless of whether the idea is immediately usable or not usable at all, or somewhere in between. Gratitude, information, and an invitation. Gratitude, thank you for thinking about how we can be better. I appreciate you taking the time and energy. Information. Hey, listen, here's some additional information that might help. And that information might be, hey, your idea is so good, it's actually already been implemented, which happens in larger organizations, right? It might be, hey, here's some more strategic information or some competing priorities you might not have been aware of. Then the invitation step is you invite them to continue thinking about where you need a great idea, or if their idea has merit and needs to develop or bake a little bit more, like, hey, listen, here's some additional information. I'd love to have you keep thinking about this and process this and come back with some suggestions that'll achieve both your goal and what's going on in this other department. Right. So we have a chance to build culture when we can leverage what is happening and respond with regard is one of the critical components to make that happen.
Cool. Would you go over the IDEA again? I'm going to have Allison put that into the chat so we make sure.
Absolutely. I is interesting.
Interesting, right.
Mm-hmm. And that is interesting is basically representing, is it strategically relevant? Does it solve a significant problem?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
D is doable. Do we have agency to do this? Is this within our realm of action? E is engaging. Right? And this is your stakeholdering, right? Who else needs to be involved, to be on board, mm-hmm. To support? What would be their concerns? Have I thought about those in any capacity, and how might we address them? And then A is for actions, and that is specifically identifying the one or two next practical steps, observable steps that would be taken in order to move forward on this idea.
Awesome. Great. Thank you for that. Okay. So let's go on to what we had promised before, this idea of courage crushers. Okay. What are some of these hindrances or courage crushers these leaders and HR professionals should be looking for? Which poses the greatest or most pervasive threat?
So there are two levels of these sorts of things. So let's start at the basic level, which is if it takes courage for somebody to show up every day and do their job, you're never going to get the level of innovation, problem solving, creativity, micro innovation. None of that's going to happen. People are using up all their courage muscles, everything they've got to just keep going, to just do it again today. So what are those kinds of courage crushers, right? Well, that's the any kind of toxicity in a workplace, any kind of bullying, harassment, any of those things, me too, you know, stuff like that. If you're tolerating any of that, you're not ready for a courageous culture. You know, you have to eliminate that and have zero tolerance about those things. And I know sometimes that's easier said than done, particularly if it's coming from a high performer who is being productive in some way, but there is a huge cost to the rest of your team or organization if you're tolerating that. So that's a look in the mirror and make sure that you're not tolerating any of those types of things. You want people using their courage to be thinking about, oh, I have a risky idea that might not fly, but I got to put this out here because I think there's a chance, right? That's where we want people using their courage. So then from there, assuming you don't have any of the toxicity and you've addressed that, the next level of things that are courage crushers to be aware of is some basic human psychology. Dr. Amy Edmondson from Harvard, one of the pioneers in psychological safety, she wrote The Fearless Workplace, and she wrote the foreword to our book. She identified two aspects of human psychology that play into this. And you need to be aware of this as a leader because it's happening regardless of what kind of leader you are. Mm-hmm. One is that people tend to hang on to negative experiences. We overweight those things. And so we've talked to so many people in the course of the research for this book that, yeah, I had this negative experience 10 years ago. I spoke up and I got drilled for it. Never making that mistake again. Well, was that at this company? No. Okay. Right. But they're hanging on to it. Right. And so that happens. And then the other thing that happens is that people tend to discount the future benefit of an idea they might contribute. So yeah, I saw this solution in my, it's not going to make that big an impact. It's not that big a deal. Both of these human tendencies contribute to people just putting their head down and doing their work. It's like, yeah, no one gets punished for keeping quiet. Well, as a leader, you need to be aware that that is the natural bent of 80-85% of your general workforce. And so if you're not intentionally building a different culture, intentionally asking the courageous questions, intentionally modeling the vulnerability and courage yourself, intentionally responding with regard, celebrating it when somebody takes that risk and contributes, if you're not doing those things intentionally, you will have the reversion to that norm of basic mm-hmm. humans.
That's what I'm getting more than anything out of your talk and your ideas, is that the modeling is so important here. That if you don't model the courageous leadership, courageous culture yourself, I mean, then it's going to be really, really hard to get other folks to.
Yep.
And also, if you accidentally diminish, you know, what Liz Wiseman talks a lot about, accidental diminishing, which I love. It's like, you know, people will, a leader will give their all of it, be courageous and give all their ideas out, but then not give the space for other people to have ideas. So they're so they may be courageous themselves, but so courageous that they're not letting anybody else be courageous too. So there's that problem too.
Yep. Guilty. I've done that.
Yeah, guilty too.
had an executive coach I was talking with many years ago in my development. And I said, you know, I'm not getting the feedback from the team I want. And she said, David, how are you presenting your ideas? And we talked about it. I was like, oh, yep, that's on me.
Yeah. That's something that I'm working with somebody right now that so smart, you know, just so smart. And I just said, hey, you know, you gotta like say something and then invite. So you can advocate, but then invite stuff. So what do you guys think about that? And leave the space for it. You know, don't interrupt. And again, it's not horrible or anything. I mean, it's everyone's well-intended, but the idea of courageous means that you've got to let people show up and let people speak and let people not, and letting is not even that word.
It's
courage.
Yes. There is a huge difference between permission and invitation right. that, okay. Hey, I've shared an idea of my own. I put this, hey, I think there's a problem here and I'm interested in, you know, like, okay, here, and here's my solution. And even if the team loves it, like, are we inviting, okay, listen, I want to hear what is the one thing that's going to derail this project, this implementation, this mm-hmm. thing we're doing mm-hmm. if we don't address it?
Yeah, be specific in the questions. So I say, it's like, what do you guys think? It isn't necessarily going to get to what's needed because you're not being specific in the invitation. Yeah.
One of my favorite examples of this is Don Yeager. He's a chief operating officer for a contact center. And he likes to regularly, at least once a year, if not more often, ask his frontline employees, what's one policy of ours that just sucks? And that's how he phrases the question. And of course, these people who are talking to their customers every day, they know the policies that are frustrating and ticking off their customers. And so, but by saying, hey, what's one?
Just one.
What's one? And when somebody says that and says, you know, well, here's one that I'm hearing. Oh, great. Thank you for sharing. I appreciate you sharing that. What's another one? Who else has one? Right. And it opens the door. First the ask, then the positive response. No, I welcome this. This is really good. Of course, he's the one making the policy. So he's being vulnerable, you know, and you're absolutely right. That modeling is so vital. It's actually the first step in that we have a 7-step process of building a courageous culture. The first step is to navigate the narratives. And that is to tap into your own moments of courage as a leader so that you're able to be vulnerable and take these steps. And then it's to surface some of those same narratives that are happening in your team and find out what their hopes and their fears are. Mm-hmm. And let's get these on the table and not have them be the hidden things that are happening. We're just not talking about it.
So you mentioned the 7 steps. Let's end with that. And I'm gonna like give people some 10 minutes so they can go in before the next meeting. So
I love it. Love it. We got to model, model what we're doing. It
gives us 10 minutes as well. So, all right. So 7 steps, if you can go through those and then we'll finish.
Absolutely. Number one, navigate the narratives. And that's mm-hmm. What I was just talking about is as you know, the courage in a courageous culture is leaders mm-hmm. go first. So tapping into your own moments of courage, finding that and showing up vulnerable and also being courageous in your representation of your team, right? So if you're in middle level leader at some point, you know, are you raising your hand and speaking up? Mm-hmm. And can your team watch you do that with your leaders or your peers? Mm-hmm. All right. Second is to create clarity. And you want to get really clear around two things. One is that you really do want people's ideas and their thinking. And then secondly, like we mentioned earlier, to really clarify yourself where you most need a great idea. We hear frequently from people, oh, I'm going to get too many ideas. It's overwhelming. They're not strategically relevant. So ask for what you want. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Where do you most need a great idea? And help direct people that way. So create clarity. Then we're going to cultivate curiosity. And so we talked about ways to do that with courageous questions, a number of other techniques to use, but that's a strong, immediately applicable one. As you cultivate curiosity, you respond with regard. How are we responding to the ideas that we're hearing? And the moment, the small moments of courage people are having, are we reinforcing those, celebrating them, and then asking for more? From there, there's another thing that we haven't talked about today called practice the principle. And this is, how do you scale a good idea? One of the mistakes that leaders will frequently make is they'll see something that's working on this team and they'll say, oh, look at, that's a best practice. We got to, boom, everybody's going to do that. Well, it may not translate. The specific practice may not translate across teams. There's usually a principle underneath that practice that will. And so, for, you know, the example I share in the book was a guy I worked with who cooked these lovely homemade Italian meals for his team for their excellence rallies. Well, one of his peers was talking to me in confidence and she said, I can't boil water. You know, I like his rallies better than mine. And I'm never going to be able to do that. Well, she was missing. It wasn't about cooking the meal. It was about personal connection in an intimate way that felt real for you as a leader, right? That's scalable. That's transferable.
Right.
So that's practice the principle. Building an infrastructure for courage, which is addressing, there are systems in every organization, every team, and they're either contributing or taking away. And what culture are they contributing or building towards? And then galvanize the genius,
right?
Which we had mentioned earlier about the communication techniques used to reinforce as you're sharing and cascading and implementing good ideas and making sure that you're not reverting back to the norm of the way things were.
Good. All right. Thank you so much. I appreciate all your ideas. I love that. The fact you've got a nice little light bulb on top of you. It's right. Like all these ideas are percolating out of you. I love it. So let me just give everybody your website. Let'sGrowLeaders.com. Twitter is at David M. Dye, and that's D-Y-E. And certainly can follow you on LinkedIn. And Courageous Cultures is the name of the book with your co-author and your wife, Karen. Just want to make sure everybody has a chance to go and connect with you and to buy your book, read your book.
And we'd invite everybody who, you know, you can go to CourageousCulturesBook.com and it will forward you. You can get an assessment you can take, a free couple of chapters, and, you know, all kinds of things there for you.
That sounds great. Thank you so much, David, for being with us. And
my pleasure.
You're welcome. I just want to let everyone know about next time. We're going to meet with Larry Robertson. He's the author of Rebel Leadership, How to Thrive in Uncertain Times. And I got to talk to Larry the other day, and we're going to talk a lot about uncertainty. And if we think it's been uncertain in the last year, I think that we're in for a little bit more of that because of this hybrid model. So how are people going to deal with that? There's some things that are not going to be uncertain anymore. We can go back if we want, but then there's going to be uncertainty about whether we should or not. So I think it's going to be a great conversation. That's May 25th at 1 p.m. Pacific. Thank you again. Thanks everybody on the call. We will see you next time on May 25th. Bye now.